Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Ma Anand Suresha. Suresha took sannyas in 1978 and is a healer, osteopath, body worker and author of various books. Suresha developed the Neurosomatic Integration System and founded the Marin Center for Somatic Education. Suresha, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you, Swaram.
Okay, excellent. So to start, tell us a little bit about how you came across Osho.
It was a pretty magical sequence of events, actually. I didn't realize it at the time, but when I looked back, I noticed that several things many years in advance of my meeting him led me to him. And when I tied it together, it started fitting maybe when I was 19. I didn't meet him for like 10 years, but I never ever thought that I would be in New York, but I just happened to have some seeds planted when I was in college about a master. And I was thinking of a martial arts master at the time. And then when I left college and moved to Atlanta, I met someone who had a martial arts master. And I thought, oh my God, that would be great. I would love to meet a master, but he lived in New York. I never wanted to live in Manhattan. But I wanted so much to meet a master that I just packed up everything and moved with my daughter to New York. And within 3 weeks, I came across a book of Bhagwan. We called him Bhagwan in those days. Now he's Osho. But that book, you know, I had been in college, so I was reading so many books for years and years. And I'd never had a book affect me the way this one affected me. And I just was blown away. It was like he was speaking things to my, it was like he was speaking to my soul, something really, really deep and something that I had been searching for my entire life. I couldn't put words on it, but when I read the book, I knew that this would be the core of my life from then on.
After you read the book, how did you then get involved more with Osho, with the perhaps sannyasins? Did you go to some Osho center in your area or did you just go all the way to India? So how did you end up living in India?
Well, I had moved to New York to take these martial arts classes and hadn't found a place to live yet. So I put an ad in the Village Voice. And as you know, Manhattan is huge and there were millions of people there. But the first two people who answered my ad were sannyasins. So I thought that was pretty serendipitous in and of itself. And I moved in with a sannyasin and she happened to have scores of books and tapes by him. So I began reading the books, everything she had, and listening to the tapes every night. And I met some sannyasins while I was there. It was at that time that I found out he was still alive. I didn't realize that he was even alive. I hadn't had a plan, just like I didn't have a plan to move to Manhattan. I didn't have a plan to move to India. But when I went to the meditation center, I started doing some of the meditations. These kind of metaphysical experiences started happening. At the same time, I was doing these really intense exercises in this martial arts class. It was an internal arts class. And between that and doing these, doing dynamic meditations, I think I was doing Nada Brahma also, I started having really unusual experiences and they were freaking me out a little bit. So, so my roommate mentioned that I should speak with Bodhicitta at the time, and he told me that I should go to India. It was like telling me to go to the moon. I don't know if, you know, you can imagine what it was like for my mentality at that time, just growing up in Ohio. You know, I was a housewife with a child. You know, I had a profession as a psychologist. And yeah, someone telling me to go to India was just like so out of my whole zone. But he convinced me. I just felt like, okay, I'll go. I couldn't afford it. I was trying to find work there at the time, but he just said, get the money and Yeah, I said, yeah, I'll just be really proactive with this, and I'll find a way to get the money. And I did, and we went, my daughter and I went for the first time in 1979, and I was blown away. It was really, really, really incredible. I just couldn't imagine how any sannyasin wouldn't want to be there in India with him.
Okay, so you were blown away. You went to Pune and it was incredible. Can you remember or can you describe the first time you saw Osho in person?
Yes, we have what they call arrival darshan. So whenever a new person comes, you have this opportunity to meet him. I had already taken sannyas when I was in New York. There was a sannyasin who just, I don't know why, we had a good connection and she really wanted me to join and she just convinced me. And so I already had a name. And when I went to see him, there was this powerful energy field, unlike anything I'd ever felt before. And I actually feel like, you know, so like something you see on a sci-fi movie where there's a force field around a spaceship that's invisible, but when the other ship bumps into it, you kind of see it vibrate. It was like that. And I walked into it and I kind of bumped into it with my face. And then I sat down right there. And Shiva was there and he kind of motioned me to sit down, but I was already sitting down because I had bumped into that field. And I was a little bit afraid. Because it was so new and I thought, oh my God, what in the world is that? How is that possible? And so I was in this kind of wide eyed, open mouth zone and he kind of saw that. So you know how you hadn't seen, but maybe you've seen him on videos where his cheeks go up, you know, he gets that little smile and his eyes twinkle and his cheeks go up. So it probably was a little bit funny for him. Yeah. That's what it was like, that very first meeting. And, you know, he asks a little bit about you, where you're from and all that. And then he looks at you and he has this way of, you know, he's one with you, right? He's one with you. So he knows everything. He probably knows more than you know about yourself when he looks at you. And he recommends three groups for you to do while you're there. And that's what he did. He recommended for me Nataraj, the Samadhi tank, and centering.
You said that he can look at you and know more than, you know, than yourself in a way. You said, you know, they can look deep inside your mind and your heart. So
right.
Did you have, apart from the first meeting that you just described, did you have any further experience of this, or did you have any personal one-to-one meetings or personal guidance from Osho at any point in form of questions, letters, or anything like that?
Well, yes. You know, I was there on a 3-month visa, and so we left. My daughter and I went back after 3 months, and you are able to have a departure. You know, you can have a leaving darshan as well. So I got to see him again then, and it was then that I had the intention to get rid of whatever I had left in terms of my belongings and just move to India. So within 6 months, you know, it was again very magical how work opened up and I was able to make enough money to get back there. I sold everything I had, was down to 2 suitcases. All my belongings were in 2 suitcases and I moved to India with my daughter. And then you get another arrival darshan. So I got to see him again. And then every 3 months you get an energy darshan, you know, and I guess they figure it takes about that long for you to be able to process the energy that he gives you where, you know, you get in front of him and he touches you on the third eye. And then at some point, I guess someone found out that I was a martial artist, so I was invited to help train the guards, and I became a samurai and was positioned in his house and sat next to the podium during the lectures, during the discourses. So I was able to, I was really, really lucky that I was able to be near him as I was, and to be around him as often as I was. Yeah, it was pretty incredible how over the moon. I was really, really deeply, completely in love with him. And then you know how that is. If you have that going on, what it means to be able to be near someone that you care that much about. And I felt really, really elevated by his presence and by him. And, you know, I knew that I wasn't the only one. I was also a group leader while I was there. I had begun when I was in Manhattan, I had begun studying shiatsu. So I shifted my profession, but I also studied rebirthing while I was there. I did a rebirthing training. I had studied shiatsu while I was in New York for a couple of years. So I was a group leader. And for a while in one of the groups, I had the members dance their path to meeting Osho. And for each person, you could see in what they were expressing through their bodies that it was magical for them as well. It's like he appeared at just the perfect moment in their lives, wherever they were. And they were from everywhere, you know, anywhere you can imagine, all over the world. And, you know, they hadn't heard of him. And then all of a sudden, at this moment in their lives, this turning point, either they would come into the presence of one of his books, or a sannyasin would just show up out of nowhere, you know, just walk down the beach or come around the corner and let them know about Bhagwan. So he was really, you got the sense that he was a true master, because he was consciously everywhere. It's not like in a different sense, you know, in a knowing sense, in a consciousness sense. Not that he had all these physical bodies out there, you know, viewing what's going on in the world everywhere, but in terms of that degree of awakeness that enlightenment can bring. But he was a master, you know. I don't think this happens to everyone when enlightenment comes.
Yes, I really want to go deeper on this topic of Osho as a master, but I'm also very curious to hear more about your role as a samurai. We never really discussed that into details. So can you describe what was your role? And I guess Osho needed physical protection, so you were there to guard him somehow. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. You know, he had been lecturing around India for quite a while, and he was known, and he was very popular. I don't know if you know this, he was a genius, you know, he was a brilliant debater, and thousands of people would come to hear him speak. And at some point, you know, every now and then he would come across someone who was a little upset, because he would push the edges of the religions and just challenge how they influence society, and it would push people's buttons. And he would do that intentionally. He told a story once about someone who'd come to one of his discourses and threw a shoe at him. And then he just joked with the guy. You know, he didn't take anything very seriously. He would say, "What, just one shoe? You're going to be so cheap now, you're not going to throw the other shoe? And bless your aim is horrible." And so we all laughed, but there were these instances, and I think I'd heard stories also of people trying to climb over the fence where he lived and have access to him. So he did need guards to protect him.
I see. Have you had any situation where you had to use your skills as a martial art expert?
No, I didn't. Luckily, during that time and right around the time I was taking sannyas, something had switched in me, and I realized that my true path was one of harmlessness. I'd had a couple of incidents while I was in the external art of karate and had hit someone accidentally. You know, in those days, it's different now, but in those days, you know, you were really learning it as an art, and, you know, you were supposed to just come within a fraction of an inch of someone. You could hit them in the chest, in the body, but around the face, you're just supposed to come within a fraction of an inch. But if they moved, you know, maybe they were trying to come towards you at the same time, then there's going to be contact. And a couple of times when I made contact with someone, I noticed that I shared, it's like on an energetic level, I shared that contact with them, and I felt it in a way that was really uncomfortable. And I felt like, wow, this is not me. This is really not my thing. I don't think I want to go around punching people. But I was still, you know, I was still good at it. I had been doing it for many, many years. Luckily, there'd only been one incident in Buddha Hall during a lecture, a discourse, where an Indian man stood up and literally threw this sword. It was like a short sword, maybe like a hatchet or something, towards him. And we all kind of, you know, were caught in this very still moment where time doesn't seem the same anymore. It's like it freezes for a fraction of a second. And all the guards stand up, but the ones right near the podium, and I wasn't near the podium at that time, all the guards near the podium kind of surrounded him and whisked him away. It was really a very shocking, but I didn't have to fight anyone or do anything at that point or at any other point. And now I think there weren't any other incidents. There, it may have been right after that too, that there was a kind of an entryway that you had to pass through, and people were checked, you know, make sure that there were no weapons.
I heard about that incident. Interesting to hear you were there, and glad that everything went well. So you mentioned before that Osho was a real master, and today for newer generations, you know, for younger people, especially in the West, the word master is something that it's indigestible in a way. You know, there is this association with brain control, of lack of freedom, and especially then if you think of Osho, he has this kind of reputation as a cult leader, as, you know, if you look at Wild World Country and all the rest. But in our email exchange before the interview, you said that for you, freedom is the highest value, and that's what brought you to Osho. So I'd love to hear how you, in your life and your experience, balance or put together freedom with being with Osho as a master.
Well, that's a really good question. I think people who grow up in a free country, quote unquote, don't realize what they're actually bound by. And they also don't understand what a spiritual community is like or what it's for. But because it's so different, it seems like, and we were dressing alike, right? And we all had the mala with his picture on it, and it looks from the outside like you're being controlled. And I guess that's what people see as a type of independence, you could say, that you can come and go as you like, you know, dress the way that you want, say what you want, and so forth. And they're not paying attention to the fact that if there weren't rules in society, there would only be chaos. You know, probably India is the only country in the world who doesn't use traffic rules the way that they should. But it works, you know. It's incredible to see all these animals and people and motorcycles and trucks and rickshaws just zoom around there without any stop signs. I think they have one or two in the whole city sometimes, but it's a miracle. Yeah, I mean, there were more regulations that way, I guess, on the ranch than there were in India. But the freedom he was talking about was freedom from your mind. He was talking about freedom from your ego. And that is the true freedom. And in that case, you can be anywhere doing anything and have any type of rules or regulations that you abide by or not abide by. It's not a form of licentiousness. It's a form of you understanding what's an illusion and, you know, what real ignorance does to you in your life, and how restricting it is, how limiting it really, really is, just to have beliefs that have been handed down either by your parents, by your peers, you know, by society. And these are the real oppressive features that limit the freedom that you could have. You know, look what we start doing to a child as soon as they're born. I mean, we just like lay all kinds of concepts on them, including the concept of who they really are. And we just squash them as human beings and as the potential that they could have lived through, lived as. It may be a little bit less now because of masters like Osho and you know, the beings that have come in and given us a light that could guide us into a space that doesn't have as many restrictions on it and has the potential of complete freedom. It's such a blessing that I think most cultures don't understand, you know, when they live according to mores, I guess you could say, you know, just things that they've learned and that are embedded in their subconscious that are actually controlling them, and they don't know that it's controlling them. But I kind of knew as a child, I felt some type of oppression, and I knew that I didn't want that. You know, so it was in me when I was like 10 or 11 years old, and I just felt like, wow, this doesn't even feel right. You know, it looks like a form of rebellion, you know, when you're questioning, you know, why do you get to tell me what to do? Why do you think you know more than I do? All these kind of things that a lot of kids normally go through in adolescence, but they're real questions, you know, that deserve real answers to. When I first began reading Bhagwan's books, I went, yes, now we're talking. This is the real stuff. So unfortunately, anything out of the ordinary, and guess where the ordinary comes from? Nobody even asks. They just assume, you know, that's where this whole thing about being a sheep that just follows the herd, and you're not even wondering where you got the idea from that you belong to a herd. You're just in it. But anything that comes against those mores, those self-imposed rules that are now part of your psyche that you don't question, anything outside of that becomes suspect. It's like this animal mentality, you know, where it's a threat if there's something that comes into your territory that looks or sounds or acts differently than you. Maybe they're going to take your food or your women or your property or whatever. You know what I mean? It's really, really primitive way of thinking, but somehow nobody questions it. No, right? Nobody questions it. You've got your little group, and they don't think they have a little cult at all going, but you got your little group, and this is the way that we think and we feel, and everybody should think and feel the way we do. And if you don't, you know, we're against you, and we have all this divisiveness and polarization, and it still goes on in so-called Western society where they think they're free. And this is the layer, the level that I think the question should be happening on, rather than taking groups that are cloistering themselves in order to free themselves, because consciousness is a form of transmission. And he knew this. He knew that regardless of what you do while you're here, just be near me. You know, it's not something that can be taught. It's something that can be caught. And if you just sit here, you can fall asleep, do whatever you want, but there is something that happens beneath our conscious minds or beyond our conscious mind that transcends our conscious minds. That's the real communion. That's the real communication that we're all here for. And we're all radiating and sharing this same communion, which is helping everyone together become elevated into this more, you know, transcendent, to this higher potential that we're all have as our birthright. So that's the real reason that the community forms, because the community kind of reinforces that transmission, and you can all kind of stay in that same mind frame. It's not a mind frame into, you know, into that layer of consciousness. It's not even a layer, but, you know, it's hard to describe, but there are reasons for that. You know, there are reasons for the color that he chose. There are reasons for the color orange. There's reason for the mala, it's 108 beads. There's a lot of symbolism in everything that he did. You know, this was his genius, and people misinterpret it and just, you know, react to it. So that's the way that I experienced it. And you feel a difference when you go outside of it. You know, when you leave the commune and you go even into town, at some point, you know, you have your own feel that comes with you, but you know, you can feel the consciousness shift, you know, when you go out of it. And then there's this whole transmission of the collective that you have to kind of be strong enough within yourself, within your own being, to compete with, because it has its own transmission. You know, that's why parents tell their kids, you know, pick your friends wisely and all of this. I don't know if I'm talking too long, but yeah. So does that answer your question?
It does, absolutely. No, thank you for putting it out there so beautifully. And obviously you had direct experience of that. And in terms of today, do you feel that there is the same misinterpretation, misunderstanding? For example, when you talk to people and they perhaps have seen Wild Wild Country, or they've heard of Osho, obviously reading some bad media review, whatever, and you say that you were there, and perhaps you say, you know, Osho is my master. Do you still get skepticism or misunderstanding? Is that anything changed between before and now?
You know, at some point he told us, you know, just don't even wear the color in the mala anymore, because it draws attention to you. You know, things ended badly, as you know, in Oregon. So we became targets for a while. And, there was one point when I was trying to find a place to live, when I came back to California, where I was unpacking, and the woman saw a book of his and said, "You can't live here." And I said, "Well, why? You know, that's discrimination." She said, "I don't care. You just know, you know." And so it took a while, I think, for it to die down, and for it to die down in the news as well, because that was pretty intense what was going on. But, you know, California is such a hub of spiritual activity, and there are a lot of teachers who come through here. There are a lot of different ways that people practice their spirituality here, a lot of teachers. You know, and he mentioned, you know, try to be with a living master. You know, that's the best gift. That's the best teaching that you'll ever get, is being in the presence of a living master. So we might be in a little bubble here, but these days people will say, "Oh, I know a lot of sannyasins. Yeah, they're great. I like sannyasins." So I think it's the kind of flip the script, so to speak, in that way. And I don't know if there is that much of a distinction in people's minds between a teacher and a master. There is in my mind, because there aren't that many people who function, you know, moment to moment, second to second, the way that he was able to. You know, I think a lot of people have had awakenings and have full awakenings, but it's just different. Yeah.
Okay, I'm glad to hear about California, which is seems to be open-minded and accepting, and lots of
sannyasins. Not everywhere, but some communities where I live in this county. Yeah.
Good for you. Good to hear. And also, yeah, totally agree with you on this, emphasizing the difference between a teacher and a master. And that's a little difficult to explain. I hope, for example, recording your story and your interview and your beautiful way to put it is a way to do that. So when you were in the commune, in addition to being a martial arts teacher and samurai, you were also a body worker, and that's what you then developed to be professionally. So we mentioned in the introduction that you even created a whole system and you have a healing center. When it comes to healing and Osho, what have you learned from Osho that helps you in your work as a body worker and healer today?
Well, that's a good question. There is something about being able to do anything, but also to practice body work in a Buddha field. You know, anything that you do there is so augmented, is so elevated, because you feel that presence. And I had developed this question about how that transcendent state, it's not really a state, but you could say that status, that transcendent status, could interpenetrate, you know, these more sublime, these subtle layers of being, and participate with the physical, our physical lives, our physical form, in a way that can help it to regain or to retain balance and possibly to heal? What is it that we can see more consciously if we're more awake and aware in our physical form, that if we were able to have that with us from day to day or moment to moment, could prevent illnesses from happening? And if something were coming, can you ward it off through that continuum, you know, awareness of that continuum from the subtle into the gross physical world? You know, there was this kind of battle between the spirit and the flesh, you know, that I was trying to mitigate and kind of bring them together. And I think being able to be a body worker in the Buddha field was really helping me to see it. And it took years. It probably won't now, you know, how, you know, we as part of that collective of sannyasins and of spiritual beings, you know, I think we all sharing that space together, you know, we inform each other and we're continually being led to what we need in order to answer those types of questions. So the types of body work that I was led to, still part of that same magic, enabled me to come across these forms of working with the system that are they themselves informed by the higher power, by the divine. And the system, because it's interpenetrated, it's made of, that's the stuff it's made of. That's the stuff that enlivens us, our bodies. It's a form of communication and communion as well. It's a form of coherence that the body can read, the heart can read, the subtle bodies can read and return to coherence with, because that's a huge part of who we are and how we commune with nature, with everything. And then that communicates in turn with our nervous system, with our energetic systems that feed and nourish and enliven everything that we are and helps it to return to balance. So I think he enabled that to happen because I was so in love with him. You know, his presence was really, really with me. It was really overwhelming during those days when I would work with people because of what would pour through. And I had to just kind of gradually learn over time how to interpret, you know, what I was seeing, what I was sensing, and how to work with it, and how to create a form around that so that it could help people to reorganize their systems and to get better. And then so I learned a couple of forms of neuromuscular reeducation and within osteopathy, and there's so many techniques, but the real philosophy is how you interpret what the body is and how you are in relationship to it. And even that is a form of communication to the body, that the body knows immediately how you're being in relationship to it. So when you have that reverence, and that understanding of all the fields that impact us from the subtle to the gross, and that's in your hands when you touch someone, then the system knows that and it responds differently and it opens differently and it shows itself differently.
So you mentioned that you learned this work in the Buddha field and you were so in love with Osho and that was kind of elevating. How do you feel today? Do you still feel the connection with Osho?
Yeah, I do. I do. In those days, I had learned shiatsu, and while I was in Pune, I was doing shiatsu only and rebirthing. But since then, I probably studied 15, 20 other different modalities and did several other trainings, you know, for 2-3 years and each. So, you know, I just dove into trying to understand as much as I could about the body and about the psyche. You know, I studied hypnotherapy and the subconscious and everything I could, organs and vascular and fluids and so forth, to see how these systems work. So, you know, the part of it that he still participates in and that existence participates in, well, you get to find out that, right, when he left, he said, you know, I'm still here, I'm everywhere. And so you get to understand that existence is always participating with us if we're aware of it. And I go into sessions with that to try to be that way with the session, be that way with the client, and hold the body in that frame of reference so that when we're making contact, their bodies are able to orient to their deeper nature. And then that deeper nature is able to come up through the cells and up through the tissue and relate to whatever they're experiencing as tension or pain or contraction that's creating that syndrome is that they're experiencing. So it's definitely here today. If I would go to a satsang with other sannyasins, we feel him. I believe we all do. You know, we feel him very much. And if I would sit with him, I wouldn't want to separate him from everything, you know, from all that is, from existence. It's just like he's everywhere.
What would you say is Osho's biggest contribution to humanity?
Well, you know, I think part of it is Zorba the Buddha. I think he had a plan going in. He was holding on. He was always saying, and part of what kept me there, it wasn't easy being in India. Some people were really adapted to that environment, but it's kind of harsh, especially in those days. That being said, I loved it when it's really primitive and animals are everywhere. I just love that part. But, you know, it's really hot, you know, it's like, and it doesn't cool off at night, no air conditioning and no showers and all that. But I think he would say, you know, I'm only tethered to my body by a thin thread. Be with me while you can. So that really landed in me. And I really wanted to be around him as much as possible. I had the feeling too, that he felt pretty complete with where he had taken things, in the sense that he really wanted us to be alive while we were alive. That Zorba the Buddha phrase that he used, where he didn't want this separation either of the spirit and the flesh. He wanted us to realize that this very body, the Buddha, is what's happening, and to take that Buddhahood that is your birthright and go out and celebrate and live. You know, life needs joy. Life needs unbridled love and caring and compassion and awareness and this conscious way of participating in life. So, you know, dance like no one is watching, you know, disappear into the dance kind of thing. So I don't know if it's like that where you've lived, but, you know, when you've been in the community and then you come back and you feel this, you feel the sidewalks and the cement buildings, and people are driving around in their metal cars, and there's all this kind of separateness, and it feels literally like you're bumping up against something. Whereas when you're in the community, and even in India itself, there's openness everywhere. You know, that the shops are outside. You eat outside. People are building furniture and having haircuts outside. You purchase your food in the market that's outside. Everything that we did in the commune was outside. And there was open affection, you know, there was open affection. It's not just like with this person in this particular way, at this particular time, you get to share affection. Everybody was able to share affection. You know, you look in somebody's eyes and there's this spaciousness, this ability to share openly that, you know, some people just have a real problem with. You know, when I came back to society, in addition to all of these other artificial forms of separation, you know, when you meet another human being, there's this incredible armor, and you have to just like, maybe you can shake a hand or something, and maybe you can lean in with your shoulders and do a little touch, or, you know, so you can, there's so many, these kinds of controls on where you can share, how you can share, if you can share, when you can share. And, you know, those types of freedoms were something that he cultivated in us that society was starving for. I mean, Europe may not be quite as bad, but I think United States has the lowest rate of touch of anywhere in the world. That's probably why there's so much disease here. It's just so unhealthy. So yeah, he brought a new way of being, you know, that 100th monkey effect, where if enough people have that shift in consciousness, it just can kind of go out throughout consciousness and get downloaded that way on the internet, so to speak. So I think he shared something that society really needed that continues to spread on its own. It's kind of like that domino effect, the butterfly effect. It just ripples through.
So we are heading towards the end, and I have three final questions. But before that, is there anything else you would like to add, anything that we didn't cover or didn't ask that you want to share?
Well, there was one thing about the difference between a teacher and a master that I wanted to bring up just so that it might be easier to resonate with people. I mean, like I said, initially where I heard it was in the context of a martial arts class where our teacher, our sensei, left and we asked why. And he said, I wanted to study with a master. And I felt then, well, yeah, why would I want to study with a teacher when I could study with a master? And then I discovered, you know, we had tournaments in those days. And when you go to tournaments, these masters from Asia would come and do a demonstration during halftime. And you could see that they had developed skills that were uncanny, that there were things that they learned that were beyond anything that you can imagine. You know, the guy that I was studying with in New York, he wasn't studying Aikido, but he was able to have an impact with a person and knock them over without touching them. And although it was connected to, you know, violence, so I didn't want to do it anymore. I knew that there was this whole world within martial arts that led itself within itself to enlightenment. You know, I mean, just when you get a black belt, that's just like graduating from high school, you know, and then there's all these other degrees within that. And there's a master. It's like a self-mastery in a way, but a self-mastery that is a form of letting go into something that is so much greater. And there are these other, what they could call, I guess, cities, maybe in Hinduism, they would call them cities, but these other quote unquote powers that come with that, that you can use to your benefit. And a lot of these Qigong masters, for example, use those powers to heal others, you know, to change matter, to change, you know, cells and energy in a way that creates these amazing differences in what you experience. So, and I think that's more common knowledge that people are familiar with, looking at it within martial arts and the internal arts and developing that way, the difference between a teacher and a master. But when within the spiritual sector, they may not be as familiar with it. So I just really want to point that out and, you know, to just, yeah, encourage people, if you have that opportunity to dive into what it's like to be with a master, spiritual master, then please do so. Because, you know, one of the masters that I was with said that, you know, it's like millions and millions of merits just to be born in a free country. And to be born in a free country and to have the desire for freedom to arise, you have had to establish millions of more mountains of merits. And to have that desire arise in your mind and then to have a master actually appear, even more mountains of merits, you know, whether or not you believe in incarnation, just know that how fortunate we all are to have had the grace to come to know and to be in the presence of a spiritual master, a real master. And people may have their own definitions of that and want to house it in their own context, but just saying, go by your own experience and take a chance on that dive. And there's no greater gift that you can give your own self, your own life, than to open up this exploration in your being.
Wonderful. And I think it's very important and it's very meaningful. And just would like to add a personal note. I feel like Osho is available, is a master. And even though he's not in the body, he's very much available and it's possible to be with Osho as a master today.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure. Yeah. Just like people are still taking sannyas through reading his book, it's having an impact. His presence is always available, always available.
Beautiful. Okay, so I have three final questions. The first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Well, I have to say, I feel fortunate enough to have, I learned very early on when I was a school psychologist that I'm not a morning person. And I made it a point to have work as an independent person so that I wouldn't have to get up and leave the house in the morning, because it threw my whole system off. So I when I wake up, I check my body. I check the field around my body. I check energetic status in the room and what that information is wanting to share. And then I tune into it. Sometimes I'll sit with it and I'll contemplate with it, or sometimes I'll just meditate and clear the field. You know, there are some things that come up at night in the astral world or wherever we participate in while we're sleeping. And some of those imprints or particles are still in the field when I wake up. And if I notice that, then I'll clear that before I start my day. If it's impacted my body in a way that's created some type of restriction or stiffnesses and so forth, I'll open that up. And I'll do all that before I get out of bed, and I'll do another clearing in the shower. And I like to be in relationship with the water. Water is so precious. It's really, really beautiful. And I just, feel that on my skin. There's such bliss in that. Sometimes, you know, I'll get dressed right away. Sometimes I won't, but I will, in those first couple of hours, usually check messages and just see what wants to happen first. A lot of times, since I was in business for so long, you know, 15 years running that health center, spa, a lot of times I'll check emails or see if there's anything coming in from friends or family that I need to attend to. But I don't eat, you know, I'll drink some water. I'll eat several hours later. I learned that about my body, that it doesn't really want to deal with food right away. So maybe, you know, 2, 3, or 4 in the afternoon, I'll get something to eat.
Okay. So the second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
That's another good question. You ask so many good questions. I guess I don't know that my meditation has a form. Let me see. I sit and dissolve, I guess. I'm not sure if that's a certain type of meditation. What I'm feeling into is, you know, I guess it changes. Sometimes I feel into whatever I'm feeling into, it's space. So, but the space should be empty in my, that's just an arbitrary should. But so if there's something that doesn't feel empty, I feel through that until it does feel empty. Maybe I'll do that through my body, through the core. Maybe it will shape itself or form itself. It's almost like I'm being meditated, but sometimes it'll form itself through my heart or through the heart. There are different hearts. It's hard to describe, actually. But so I don't do a formal meditation. I just kind of sit and kind of see what happens and let it lead itself. It's like letting, the meditation or the meditative space consciousness leads itself.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Last question is, you lead the Osho experiment. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2020?
You know, I felt a big responsibility. You know, one of the group leaders, Sudha, she's not with us in her body anymore, but she told me once in Pune One, she said, we're all bodhisattvas and, you know, we have this responsibility to help others awaken even before ourselves. And there's some things that land in a certain way, and that one was one of them. But also, not that I can, you know, help people awaken, but I noticed that, you know, and Osho also talked about, when we were in discourse, he talked about seeing thoughts jump from one mind to another, and then there would be someone who would ask a question, but the question didn't originate in them. And that kind of stayed with me as well. So I felt like, what are the ways that I could participate with what I've been given, with what I've been shown, with what has revealed itself so far in consciousness that my master set in motion? And part of that is to help others to not suffer, right? To just do whatever I can to support healing, to support wholeness. And I do that through my work. Also, I feel like, and initially, even though I was aware of it, I feel like this is too much right now. I don't think I can do it. But later on, I felt like if I can be responsible for my thoughts, that would be really helpful for humanity because of what he said. And I just felt that we are all interconnected, right? We know this. And whether or not we're aware of it each time it happens, the thoughts that we put out there are influential. And I really feel if we can continue to radiate, emanate as much peace as we can, put something out there that's helpful, that is healing, that is in the direction of wholeness and peace and more love and compassion and harmony, even though it may sound altruistic, I feel that, and I've seen that existence responds to that. Life responds to that. Everything responds to that on a cellular level. That communication is happening. So I like to be a part of that as consciously as I can and not project anything out into the field or carry anything in my heart or bring anything through my body that is incoherent, that is chaotic, that is, you know, out of sorts, because I know it carries.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you so much. It's a great reminder for me about taking responsibility, not just over my actions and behavior, but also my thoughts. So that's a beautiful way of ending this interview. And thank you so much for being part of the Love Osho podcast, and send you lots of love.
Thank you so much. Lots of love to you as well. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today and share something about Osho.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.